and surely there must be questions out of that presentation. We have two microphones set up here, so we have no roving mic today. If you do want to ask a question, I'm going to ask you to get on your feet and make your way to the microphone. So I'm expecting a movement right now. But to kick off, Peter, just to pick up on the point that you were making at the end about the opportunity, and you made the comment in the presentation how the United States is drawing in all of this talent from around the world. We have a new government, we have an innovation review. What can Australia do? What should we be looking at, perhaps in a specific sense, if you were talking to Kim Carnow, to try and attract relevant talent into Australia?
I think we have done reasonably well at attracting talent. I think there's a lot of talent out there that would really quite like to live in Australia. I think I think we've all seen, if you watch the television, some very talented Indians, for instance, who are educated elsewhere, and we work with some people. I think we're in that game. I think in the long term, we've got to do everything possible to build our education system. I agree with Rudd in that, not just university education, but right across the board, and increase opportunity, because a lot of the scientists, actually, traditionally, haven't come from well-to-do families. They've often come from lower-income families, so public education, parochial Catholic schools, that sort of thing, because they see this as a way up and out, and it doesn't really matter who your dad is or what contacts you have and all the rest of it. It's just, it rests on ability. I'm not saying that's exclusive in any sense, but it does tend to be true a little, I think. And I think there's an enormous resource possibility for increasing opportunity there. But in the meantime, I think we're going to have to bring in people with talent. We're never going to have enough school teachers. The fact of the matter is school teaching has changed totally. It used to be one of the few jobs that was available to really bright women. Well, that's not true anymore. There are lots of jobs available to really bright women. I mean, they run a lot of things, don't they? So, including some of the big banks, Qantas for a time and so forth. So I don't think we're going to just be able to grow that resource. I think we can make a lot more use of online learning systems and so forth, but we do need a lot of teachers. I think maybe we can bring in more of those. But I think Australia is a very attractive place to live, and people like it here, and they want to stay. And the other nice thing about it is, as we've all realised, people come here, and they may come from an Asian background or whatever, but within a few years, many of them sound more Australian than those of us who have been born here, and they're more passionate about the place, and they pretty much absorb the ethic. Of course, if they absorb the ethic of some of our more senior citizens who believe the government has to pay for them and all the rest of it, that's nonsense.
Thoroughly enjoyed your presentation, Professor. Barry Budge from Toyota. At Toyota, Peter Griffin mentioned Kaizen, which is about continuous improvement. But there's another word called kaikaku, which is about radical improvement.
Uh-huh.
Where is the next radical improvement and breakthrough in your expertise of microbiology and immunology?
Yeah, I think we can probably do better with, say, influenza vaccines. They've been made in a very traditional way for a very long time. Another good thing that Bush did, actually put a lot more money into influenza vaccines. He realised that influenza kills the rich just as much as the poor, so he thought it was worth doing. And so that's a good thing. Unfortunately, with regard to making an AIDS vaccine, at the moment we've hit a brick wall. I can't see it going forward at this stage. I think we might get a malaria vaccine. It's going to take a while. It may not be a totally protective vaccine, but it may reduce the severity of the infection so that children particularly can handle it better. And I think that's a lot of the thinking in vaccines at the moment with some types of infections. If we could just reduce the severity, we would have sufficient protection. There are a lot of possibilities for new types of drugs, too, in the immunological cancer area and all the rest of it. But if you talk to anyone from the drug industry, the problem there is not really that there's not all sorts of intellectual property out there. It's what do you develop and what is the market for it? I mean, if you've got something for gastric ulcer, of course, it's great. But then, of course, that all got knocked out by Barry Marshall, who found a lot of it was caused by Helicobacter, and that wasn't so happy for some of the drug companies. But there's enormous advances in biomedical research at the moment. And Australia, again, has some wonderful possibilities because we have essentially a national health system, and that means we could have a national genetics and informatics system. This is a fight that David Pennington's been fighting. We've through Bio21, we developed a thing called BioGrid, working with other people that is going to be a national, is going towards being a national information system. That means we can actually find out, say, genetic profiles of why some people are susceptible to some things and some aren't. You'll have seen the recent report on prostate cancer, where some of the BRCA genes that are involved in breast cancer are actually now been shown to be involved in prostate cancer as well. We expect to find totally new information there. There's also an issue in drug development. We have, having a national health system, having a fairly diverse population, we can actually get a lot of genetic databases set up if we care to try and do that, which would actually be extremely useful for drug development. You may know the story of the COX inhibitors, that they fell down because some people were dying, I think, of heart attacks. But it could be that with a lot of drugs, it could be that you have a drug which is absolutely wonderful for 95% of the population, but dangerous for the other 5% because of their genetics. If we could use genomics and the type of information we could get from a population like Australia's, and they do get from populations like Scandinavia's, we might be able to identify what are the genetic susceptibility profiles and actually say, well, you know, we'll test you for this, and if you've got that, we don't give you this drug. That actually might greatly increase the capacity to develop innovative new drugs. It would be great.
Peter, I'm Kevin Hooper from a local manufacturing company called Frontline Australasia. Just interested in your opinion, do you classify Australia generally as an innovative country? And if the answer is no, what do we need to do to kickstart ourselves to become far more innovative in all things we do, even outside your area?
I think there are some very innovative people and some very innovative groups. I mean, we've got a very good history. If you look at biomedical, there's a very good history of innovation in biomedical devices. And you know Cochlear, the ResMed sleep mask, Peter Farrell in Sydney. I think there's efforts to develop the bionic eye now. God knows what else we'll develop this bionic. I was very impressed with this guy who runs along on big springs, but I think it was just an accident. I don't think even the Australian Institute of Sport's going to amputate people's legs to actually make them move faster. As an innovative culture, the fact of the matter is, as we're all aware, I think, is that the great majority of Australian businesses have no research activity whatsoever. The venture capital culture, I think, they will say there's not as much intellectual property around as they'd like. I mean, academics often say we've got something really terrific, but when someone with real commercial mouse looks at it, they say, well, you know, really, that's great, but there's a market for 1,000 people. It's really not going to work. We need to build that culture more. I think it has been building. It's been building slowly. I think one of the things we don't have that the Americans have is quite as good a tolerance of failure. Biotechs, for instance, fail all the time. Everybody knows that. In the US, they fail, the guys move on to another job, and they use the experience they gained last time in maybe making something work better. I don't think we're as tolerant as that. And I don't think we have had the number of what you would call angel investors. People, particularly on the West Coast that I've met, who have made enormous amounts of money out of the movie industry or something, and they just have a lot of fun hanging around scientists and seeing what strange creatures these are, and just, you know, the openness and forthrightness of it. And so I don't think we've built that so much. But there's only 20 million of us. If you compare us with the Israelis, we're not nearly as innovative as we might be. They've been under enormous pressure. You know, there is this Toynbee's theory of history. If you've got great natural resources, you don't really make a lot of the effort you might make otherwise. I mean, the curse of having oil. Look at Nigeria, massive amounts of oil. Look at the culture, look at the society, look at the politics.
Professor Richard Morrison, Saha International. You've taken us back in time a bit and around the world a bit. Appreciated that. One of the things that you said that got me thinking, you talked about the Green Revolution, and I remember as a student there was this whole thing with C3 and C4 and the much more efficient photosynthetic process, and the impact on the developing world was much more food available. And then my economist professor, who was a specialist in developing countries, said, yes, lots, much more food, and the population bred a lot more because they needed all their children, because their children, as you pointed out, their children die. And so the problem actually didn't go away. And I think you raised the issue that we've got population problems and that we're addressing and solving a lot of the disease problems. But I guess part of the solution is also continually inputting into part of the problem, which is the ongoing population growth. And I think I heard you say that the real answer to that is really economic improvement.
You know, as soon as societies become more prosperous, they decrease their population size. I mean, it just happens. And the only exception has been, I think, maybe one or two of the Muslim countries that might be a problem. But in general, as people become more prosperous, they have fewer kids. Yeah, it's time, and you know, it's a matter of how much time we've got. If we don't really become much more proactive about involving ourselves in those countries, and at the moment, aid budgets and so forth, which is maybe not the best way to do it anyway, but aid budgets are kind of going backwards. If we're going to have carbon taxes and all the rest of it, then really, you know, some of that has to go towards helping developing countries to deal with those issues of deforestation and all that. Also, there's been, you know, a lot of, particularly the U.S. Pulled an enormous amount of money out of women's health in the developing world because of the concerns about abortion. I think under a Democratic administration that would reverse. Even under Bush, it started to reverse. I don't think we can even tell the Japanese what to do about whales. I mean, obviously, if they wanted to have a bigger immigrant population, they could, but they're not doing that. Being in the Philippines, of course, their population's growing all the time. It's a very much Catholic country, and you can see these enormous areas of poverty and so forth. So I don't know. I mean, it's a very sound observation. I mean, Italy is the same, I think. So I think they're probably more open to immigration.
Let me try an interesting one. You're defining a person, I think. We've heard about the population quotes problem, which I guess implies that we define people as a problem. And yet, what it's allowed us to grow to 6 billion people in this world has been people.
Yes.
We've developed ways of, you know, better agriculture, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Paul Carter from Cochlear, coming from a business background,
yes.
Businesses tend to either grow or disappear, one or the other. So I would suggest, take your pick. We can either grow or we can disappear as a race. If we want the continued race of, you know, continuation of the race, isn't it better to have people, given that they've got a ratio of better than 1-to-1 in terms of
I think we need to at least stabilise population somewhere. We went through a quadrupling. It's obvious that's been associated with enormous environmental degradation. And we're losing species at an incredible rate in this country and everywhere. I don't think we can continue that. I mean, the hopes have been the population would stabilise at about 10 billion. Now, maybe that'll happen, and I hope that does. I think we do have to reach some sort of stable situation. The situation with Japan, for instance, where you have a lot of ageing people, eventually that's going to sort of even out at some stage, that it will stabilise. I just don't think, you know, my initial training was in veterinary science. I think there is such a thing as carrying capacity. And I think
I'll disagree, because I think if you take a view of human nature or of humanity as reshuffling the atoms, the Earth as a whole doesn't change the total number of atoms on it very much.
No.
It moves where they are, and sometimes they appear in humans and do things. But I actually think all the environmental problems that I see, I see, I don't have the solutions to all of them now, but I actually see potential solutions, and I've seen many, many problems that humans have faced and overcome. So I don't know. Maybe you're right, but maybe. Yeah.
I think have you read Jared Diamond's book, Collapse?
No.
It's an interesting book. I mean, I think it deals with some of these issues and deals with societies that don't sort of get these messages. I mean, if a society outruns its food supply, you're in kind of trouble. And if you look at for instance, what's happening with the world's fisheries, you have to be pretty concerned. So you say we go to fish farming. Well, fish farming's had its problems too. We have all sorts of infections coming through from that. You know about the scallops in Victoria and the herpes virus, for example. So
yeah.
I think there is at some point where also I think, you know, a lot of the overpopulation, if you look at say cities in India and Africa and so forth, that a lot of those people are living in very, very poor conditions. And I have the sense, I've been going to Kenya off and on for years, that basically whatever they do gets overtaken by population growth. I think it has to be stabilised. And I think human beings will do that, given the opportunity. I'm not suggesting that we wipe ourselves out. Like there was that religious sect, the Shakers, that didn't believe in sex, and they've kind of gone.
Yeah. Well, you know, admittedly, as a biologist, you'd know about the standard curve of exponential, flat, and then ka-chunk.
Yeah.
But I don't think it has to happen to humans. I'll agree to disagree. But
I don't think we can keep quadrupling.
There'll be bumps and.
Yeah. I mean, personally, when I go to Asia or India or China, I can't enjoy it. I'm just appalled by the press of human beings and the hideous pollution.
Yeah. But I mean, for example, problems in the food. Yeah, try.
Right.
Thank you. It's probably a great discussion to have once we close up, but I think it's time to move on. I was going to ask one more question, but I think we've got three for the price of one. So just to finish off, I'd like to introduce David Knox, worldwide partner from Mercer, to move voter thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, what an incredible presentation we've heard over lunch. It has covered an enormous range of topics, even as an actuary. I was able to engage, if you like, with a number of topics that were covered, ranging from bird flu through to mathematical certainty. We're taught to consider uncertainty, but according to the good professor, we had mathematical certainty on a number of topics. We have longer lives, and that, of course, interests us on longevity and pensions. We had immigration into the US and Australia. We had the demography of the developing world and social security and vaccines. We had the whole issue of smoking and non-smoking. We had greenhouse gases, and so I could go on. It was just an incredible presentation, and I think it was a real privilege for us to hear that this afternoon, presented in good humour, good intellect, and a great presentation. Could I please ask you to join with me in thanking Professor Doherty?
Thank you, David. That clearly demonstrates that innovation can take many forms if something like that's going to be born out of today's meeting. I'd like to echo David's point. It's a shame that there weren't more people here, because this is the kind of discussion and in the style of presentation that really engages so many people in these issues that may seem dry on the surface, but when you get underneath, there's plenty there. So that concludes the event for today. I want to thank everyone for coming and participating, both in the workshop this morning and then lunch today. I hope you have a great weekend, and we all look forward to the next event, and thank you, Peter.